number one myth, if we could address it, that would make a big difference in how people approach church history and doctrine.
Scott Woodward, an expert in many of the areas of church history, plural marriage, Joseph Smith, history in general, race and the priesthood.
The myth of prophetic infallibility.
People question the validity of the modern prophets.
We don't say that we believe that prophets don't make mistakes, but we say that we believe that prophets can make mistakes. But we avoid ever talking about any time they ever actually do. I'll give you one example that bothers people to no end. Question, did Joseph trespass against Emma in any way in the way that he practiced plural marriage? The answer is, it's more real.
How would you describe yourself? How would you describe it in your own words, your bio?
I'm a believer in the truth claims of the church. I'm a believer in Joseph Smith. I think he was absolutely a true prophet. As I've learned more and more about him, like that, it's nuanced to what I understand that to mean, of course. Like, what is a prophet? Like, do I think the same thing now as I did when I was 17? No, it's been nuanced, but it's more real. It's more authentic. And so as a believer in the truth claims and someone who's, hopefully, I think I've looked at
everything. Probably.
I don't know about everything.
I mean, more than most.
Okay, more than the average person, sure.
Yeah.
But this is what I do, right? I teach, and before you teach, step one is you got to learn. So
tell me about the time when you were like, I know I want to be a teacher.
Yeah, so I feel like God was like stalking me, like he was like giving me like some of the best teachers, like in the church, man, and just like,
wow,
like, Scott, you could do this, right? And so I've been blessed, man. I got off my mission, I went to BYU Idaho, and landed in. David A. Bednar's religion class.
Are you serious?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. Teachings of the Living Prophets. He was president of the university, and he taught one religion class. Yeah, and it was Teachings of the Living Prophets.
Wait. Tell me what that's like. What's it like? What's it like being in his class?
Elder Bednar's class. He was. He's fun. I don't know if you often get to see Elder Bednar being fun, like in general conference, but he's. Like he has a good sense of humor. He's also pretty straight arrow as a teacher. Like high demand, right? High expectations of his students. He said this. He said, on like, you know, our first day, syllabus day, he said, if you do everything that I ask in this class, you'll get a C.
Wow.
C is an average grade. And the average expectation for every student is that you do what the teacher asks. We're like, Elder Bednar, sir, how do we get an A if we want an A? And he's like, you're going to have to figure that out.
Whoa.
Yeah. You're going to have to come up with some A project, something that's relevant to the class. Teachings of Living Prophets, what could you do? How could you go above and beyond? I think an A is above and beyond. I think a C is average. People don't, on average, go above and beyond.
Wow.
So if you want an A, figure it out. Like, could you share some examples of what people have done?
He's no.
Like, no. I want you to be an He's agent to you. Act.
That was torture to you, wasn't it? You're like, but I mean.
Maybe just like a hint. He's like, no, just you be an agent. You act. Don't be acted upon. I don't want you just to fit some, try to guess what I'm thinking and try to do what you, like if you think something would enhance your ability to understand the teachings of the living prophets and you want to go above and beyond, do it, write it up, and make your case to me at the end of the semester. And we'll talk about, we'll negotiate your grade.
Yeah, you, really?
Yeah.
So you basically tell him what grade you want, and you have
I tell him what grade I thought I earned.
And what do you normally give it to people? You have, if you could make the case,
you
got to
make the case. Yeah. Yeah. You
in person, one-on-one?
Yeah. Yeah. So the midterm was a 15-minute interview with him, and the final was a half hour. We could ask him any questions we wanted. He said, if you want to talk about your grade for a half hour, we could do that. He said, or you could think to yourself, I'm talking to somebody who meets with the living prophets more often than their own wives. Do I really want to talk for a half hour about my grade? He said, if you just want to come in and say, Elder Bednar, this is the grade I think I deserve, and here's why, here's the work I put in, and he could say, I agree. Now we have 28 more minutes. What do you want to talk about? He said, then we could talk about whatever questions you want.
So
So that's what I did.
So what did you ask?
Oh, dude, that's private information.
Stuff. Really, really?
I'm trying to think.
You don't remember?
That was fun. No, I do remember. I remember. Hey, I remember some of them.
You're shielding it like, I don't know if I'm going to. I don't
know. Yeah, it's the sealed portion.
But was it?
It's the sealed portion of the Scott Woodward Journal.
So you met with Elder Bednar for 15 minutes at least, one-on-one.
In midterm and then another half hour for final. Yeah. So, I mean, that was him. He was just like, I'm not going to spoon feed you. You're an agent to act. So the degree of what you're going to get out of this course is going to be exactly proportionate to the degree in which you act and you're not acted upon. So yeah, high demand, but so fun to pick his brain. And, you know, so we're talking about like Elder Scott, right? That's like this week we're talking about Elder Scott, Richard G. Scott. He was a living prophet at the time, and we'd read some talks that Elder Bednar handpicked for us to read. Then we'd come to class and he wouldn't just go over the talks again. He'd say, all right, what do you want to talk about with Elder Scott? So it was a 2-hour class every Friday, once a week.
He expected you to have already read it. He didn't lecture on what it was. Yeah. He expected you to come ready.
That's right. And so we'd do things like, we'd plan before class, you know, we would get together in little clusters. Like, what should we ask? We'd ask him good questions, right? Like, he actually knows Elder Scott. Like, we should like, you know, so it was cool. So I remember on that day, actually, he said, all right, what questions do you have? That's how you'd start every class. What questions?
Love that.
Yeah. So I would raise my hand and said, Elder Bednar, have you seen Elder Scott recently? And he said, I have. I saw him on Wednesday.
Wow.
I raised my hand again. I was like, did you learn anything from Elder Scott that you could share with us, Elder Bednar? And he said, actually, I did. I told him we were going to be talking about him this Friday, and I asked him if he had any counsel for you.
Wow.
And I wrote it down right here. He pulls it out of his pocket, a little 3x5 card. And I was like, I cannot believe, like,
how cool was that?
But I don't know if he was actually going to share that with us unless we asked.
Interesting.
I don't know if he was ever going to share that.
He probably would. You think? Maybe not.
Maybe not. But he was fun that way, just to be like, you know, I have stuff to deliver, but I'm not just going to spoon feed you. You gotta be in the driver's seat as a learner. So,
and that's where the learning happens.
That's where the learning happened. Yeah. So, I mean, that's that vibe. I mean, that's ever since, like I said, mid teenage years. That's when it's been turned on since then. So that wasn't a problem for me. Like, of course, I'm going to be engaged in the learning. Like, it's one of my favorite things to do is learn, and that's why I chose your class. In fact, when I first met him on campus, I said, "Don't you teach a class here, a religion class?" He said, I do, but you probably wouldn't want to be part of it. I was like, why not? He said, because it's really hard.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, like, it's on, man.
Yeah, and he knows that. He's a good teacher, man.
He knew he was pushing my buttons. Yeah.
Yeah. So
he's a great teacher.
So what did he say in the letter? I mean, in the card, do you remember?
What Elder he Scott? Said in the council? I totally remember, yeah. Yeah, he said, here's what Elder Scott said. He said, tell your students that they were not sent to earth to be entertained. Tell them that God has sent them to earth at this time to make a difference in preparing the world for the second coming. Something like that, pretty close.
Wow.
It's like, dang.
Right. What was it like in the room when he's sitting there with the card that he wrote down as he was with Elder Scott? Or did Elder Scott write it?
He was in the elevator with Elder Scott.
Yeah, and
Elder
he writes
Scott
it down.
Said it. Elder Bednar wrote it, shared it with us.
What's the room like? Everybody's like,
yeah, there's only like 15 of us in the class, right?
Oh, wow.
So we were like, that's awesome. Right, like, anyway.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was cool.
So you had this intimate 15-student class with Elder Bednar.
It was Teachings of Living Prophets the semester before he was called to become a living prophet.
Wow.
That was cool.
That's pretty cool.
It was awesome. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, man.
Anything else you want to add with that? Any other cool experiences from that class were memorable?
Mean a ton, but I guess I'd say.
Well, the reason why I want to ask, because I feel like it's a good segue, and maybe it doesn't even include that topic, but you know, you've been teaching church history at BYU Idaho. Mm-hmm. You've been in a career as a seminary teacher. You started your career the total how many years now? In church education?
Yeah, almost 18. I guess almost 20 when you do like student teaching and all that stuff.
So for two decades, you've been teaching every day, studying every day deeply, not just to kind of know the surface stuff, but like going deep, 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 right? Yeah. In your experience, what would you say are some of the biggest myths that people have about church history or doctrine or concepts that you think could be helpful to other people?
Biggest myths.
Because I mean, the way what got me on that topic of even to even ask that is, you know, some people question a lot of times, and I don't want to assume that this is one, the validity of the modern prophets, for example, especially Joseph Smith. You know, was he a prophet? Right. Brigham Young. There's a lot of allegations like Brigham Young was like this and that and that, right?
Yeah.
And I don't want to say, I don't know if that's one of the ones that you would mention, but that's where that question came from.
I think that's the number one. I think the number one myth, if we could address it, that would make a big difference in how people approach church history and doctrine is the myth of prophetic infallibility, right? And that's a cultural myth. It's not a stated myth. We don't actually, we don't say that we believe that prophets don't make mistakes. We don't say that we believe that. In fact, we say that we believe that prophets can make mistakes. But we avoid ever talking about any time they ever actually do, right?
Mm.
And so that creates a cultural feeling of the apostles are like, I mean, they probably talk to God every day.
Mm.
Like they're right. Almost demigod status, right? That's probably overstating it a little bit, but
yeah,
but to make the point, like, and so our impulse, if you have that as like your like way you think about church history, that the prophets are always right. The apostles are always doing what God would do if he was there. They're always saying the things that he would have said. If you think that, then you're going to come at church history pretty defensively. Anytime the prophets look bad or anytime they might be potentially making an error, you're going to either be defensive of them, like which sometimes is pretty hard because it's sometimes pretty indefensible. Or then the other option would be, then I lose confidence in the prophets. Like what I thought that they were like so close to God that, or I thought that they didn't make mistakes.
Yeah.
So, maybe I've believed a myth, right? And so then you could start to pull back in your faith. You start to pull away. And some people will totally abandon them, right? So I either have to defend them on the one hand, defend something indefensible, right? Come across some statement of Brigham Young about race that is indefensible, honestly, right? So I either have to like hunker down and defend him, that no, what he's saying is true in a way, you know, it's like, no, it's not true in any way. Right. Or on the other hand, like I got to abandon Brigham Young. Right.
So very polarized.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't have to do that. Like, so the myth is that you have to do one of those two things, right? Either they are pretty much flawless or they're not. And this is a scam and we've been duped, right. Into thinking that they're, these almost demigods, but oh, look, right? Here's a little gotcha game we can now play with church history. Look, you made a mistake right there.
Yeah.
What do you say about that?
See?
There's another mistake, right? See? So now it's like, oh, shoot, right? If that's a paradigm that I hold, if I hold the paradigm that prophets are pretty close to infallible, and then I encounter their errors or mistakes, I'm in trouble, right? Testimony-wise. So I think the more healthy way to go about this is to adopt the Lord's paradigm that he drops right in Doctrine and Covenants section 1 about prophets and apostles. Like it's in D&C 1, folks, right?
Yeah.
Like he says—
The very beginning. Which people don't realize, maybe people do know, but the context of the first section is that it's not actually the first revelation. It's like the preamble. It's like the preface, right. the preface of the book.
Yeah.
So this is a very intentional piece.
Very intentional piece. Yeah. Seeking a preface to these revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants. Committee tried to write a preface and none of them loved it. And so they asked Joseph to inquire of the Lord. He inquires. We get D&C 1. And D&C 1, the Lord says there's a calamity coming. It's going to be eventually the second coming. There's calamity for the wicked. And so therefore he called Joseph Smith. And Joseph Smith, he defines him as a weak servant.
Mm.
And then he also called other servants. And gave them commandments, revelations to help guide them in the building up of the church and kingdom of God on earth to go out and tell other people. But the way he describes his servants, the ones that he calls, here's some of his adjectives, weak, simple, error-prone, and sinful.
Wow.
Oh, that's how the Lord views prophets and apostles. In Doctrine and Covenants 1, these are weak, simple, error-prone, sinful. And some of these revelations you're going to see in the Doctrine and Covenants are meant, is me working with the weakness of the language of those people. It's me working with the errors that they make. It's me correcting some of the, right, calling them out on some of the things that they did wrong.
In public, in front of everyone, the Doctrine and Covenants is filled with that.
Yeah, man. And so, yeah. So that's why I say it's a cultural paradigm that's not substantiated by the scriptures. Hmm. In fact, Doctrine and Covenants 1 begins, and then actually the very first revelation we have chronologically that was written down by Joseph is DNC 3. What's DNC 3? It is a rebuke to Joseph Smith. Hmm. This kid who has caved to peer pressure, Martin Harris, given him the manuscript that God told him twice not
that's
to give.
That's right.
Like the Lord rips him for several verses. If you don't think prophets make mistakes, that's a whopper, dude.
Yeah.
Losing 116 pages of scripture when God told you twice to not to. Mm. Like, dude, like Joseph feeling like an idiot. The Lord saying, your feelings are justified, right? But then midway through he says, but God is merciful.
Yeah.
Like 22-year-olds can't mess up the work of God. The work of God cannot be messed up by 22-year-olds. So Joseph, if you'll repent, there's still hope for you, right? But that's the first chronological revelation, right? That's DNC 3 and then DNC 1. It's meant to be the first revelation we now read is framing the prophets and apostles as these vulnerable, flawed people who God works through to bring to pass the marvelous work and a wonder. If we could just keep that paradigm.
Yeah.
It'd be amazing. Right? Can I share a scripture?
Yeah, of course.
Check this out. Like, so now go to the end of Joseph Smith's prophetic career. I'm in Doctrine and Covenants 1:24.
1:24?
Yeah, look at verse 1. So this is Nauvoo now, right? This is Nauvoo. This is about 4 years before Joseph dies.
Section what?
Section 124.
124, that's right. That's
yeah.
Right. Got it.
So verse 1, look how the Lord begins this revelation. Imagine you're Joseph Smith, right? And here's the revelation. In fact, you want to read it, Stephen?
You should read it. Verily thus saith the Lord unto you, my servant Joseph Smith, I am well pleased with your offerings and acknowledgments which you have made. For unto this end have I raised you up, that I might show forth my wisdom through the weak things of the earth. He's like,
is that a compliment?
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks. It's kind of like
was that a compliment or not a compliment? Joseph, I have raised you up to show what I can do with weak people, man. Thank you, I think. That's the Lord's view of Joseph Smith, right? Is that the marvelous work and a wonder is what I was able to accomplish through a guy like that.
Ooh, wait, whoa. That's powerful. Like, because you hear it, like, a marvelous work is about to come forth among the children of men. And according to you, you're saying one of the biggest marvels of the entire thing is that God can take fallen people and still make this miraculous outcome.
That's the miracle of the restoration right there, right?
And that's the thing in many ways that's holding us back. Mm. That's the paradox. Isn't that interesting? Mm.
Meaning what? Meaning we hold ourselves back?
We are saying, well, the fallacy, right? That these prophets are fallible and... He's saying, no, that's
what
point.
I do.
That's what I do.
I work through weak people like Joseph Smith, like Brigham Young, like Wilford Woodruff. Like, so if we're looking to the prophets for like flawless examples, we're going to be disappointed. But the Lord never told us to look for that, right? Instead, look for the miracle of what he can do through those kind of people. Like, just know that they are, right? Like, so let's do some examples. Can we do some concrete examples?
Let's do some concrete examples.
Concrete example. So let's start with something juicy. Let's start with polygamy.
Okay. That's not juicy.
I'm just joking. I don't know.
I would say that's probably the top three.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
That's relative.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. Polygamy is uncomfortable, right?
Yeah.
It's uncomfortable for anyone who's like serious about investigating it, right? On its surface, it's uncomfortable. The more you investigate it, it's still uncomfortable, right? Like it's always uncomfortable. So let me say this about polygamy. So when Joseph Smith began first practicing polygamy, in earnest in Nauvoo. So there was the first try was in Kirtland, but in earnest, when he first starts doing this, like, this almost ends his marriage.
That's right.
Yeah. This almost ends his marriage. Like, this was so hard for both Joseph and Emma. Now, pause right there, right? If our instinct is, well, Joseph is pretty flawless.
Yeah.
Then we might, our tendency would be to blame Emma, right?
Yeah. Like, why Emma, would you want to do that?
Just have more faith.
Yeah.
Just, come on, sister. Mm. Right. Just, right. But actually, like, can I show you another scripture? Mm-hmm, all right. Mm-hmm, so in Doctrine and Covenants 132, like, this is the revelation.
This
right?
is the one. It was private too, though.
Yeah. To Emma.
It was to Emma.
Yeah. 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 To try to help her understand the doctrines behind plural marriage. But in verse 56, check this out. So verse 56, the Lord tells Emma, I'll read this one.
Yeah.
He says, and again, verily I say, let my handmaid, Emma, forgive my servant Joseph his trespasses.
Mm.
Let's just pause right there. So question, did Joseph trespass against Emma in any way, in the way that he practiced plural marriage? In this context, the Lord is saying, yes. What exactly did Joseph do? Like, well, we're not sure specifically what the Lord's referring to here, but I'll give you one example that bothers people to no end. Sometimes Joseph didn't tell Emma about some of the women he had married.
Which he said that he would do at first, right?
Well, we don't know about any agreement.
We don't know. Okay.
Yeah, we don't know about any agreement up front about anything like that. I mean, the first experience he had with Fanny Alger in Kirtland was a disaster. It was a train wreck, dumpster fire, train on fire in a dumpster. It was bad.
Mm.
And so I think Joseph kind of swore off plural marriage at that point. Fast forward, what, 5 years?
This is Fanny Alger. If we remember
Fanny
Claire.
Alger, yeah. Yeah. She was a 19-year-old girl working, was kind of a maid in the house. Yeah. 14-year-old comes later in Nauvoo. But that was a disaster, right? Then an angel comes again in Nauvoo and says, it's time to start practicing again. So we might want to jump to defend Joseph. We might want to say, it was so hard the first time. Like, you don't want to tell her about some of these things, right? But honestly, like, I think, right, as I think about it, it's like, you probably should have told her.
Yeah.
Like, that could be one of the trespasses where Joseph actually trespassed against Emma, right? Now, so should we excuse Joseph for not telling Emma about some of the women that he had married? There could have been reasons, there might be justifications, blah, 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 but we don't have to justify him, right?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, let's not condemn him either. Neither Emma nor the Lord condemned him for that.
Right? Yeah.
So,
and to be clear, you're saying, I want to make sure this is clear. You're not saying you know for a fact what the trespass was, but you're saying
we don't know.
That definitely could be considered one.
That's
of them.
One. Yeah, that's one that bothers a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I say, great. Like, verse 56 is saying, hey, you're probably right. You probably should have told her.
Yeah.
But he didn't. And the Lord's asking Emma to forgive him his trespasses against her in this regard, right? So whatever they were, I think that was probably among them, right? That's my feeling is. This involves Emma one way or the other. So she should probably be, whether she's opposing you tooth and nail or not, like you should probably let her know. Anyway, I don't know. Maybe one day Joseph will say, you don't know what you're talking about, Scott. And I'd say, that's true.
But, and again, how could there be more we don't even know about.
Right. But did Joseph trespass when it comes to plural marriage with Emma in some regard? The answer is yeah. The Lord said so. Do we need to defend Joseph? No. Do we need to condemn him? Please don't, right? That's not what the Lord asked Emma to do.
Mm.
And so, anyway, so that's one example. If we can just like let the raw human be there, right? Let the weak prophet be there in the story, someone who's trying to do the will of God, but he's also trying to like figure out how to do this when he's got a wife who's pretty opposed to this practice, like, talk about a rock and a hard spot, right?
Yeah.
So did he manage it perfectly? Obviously not, right? Mm. Does that mean plural marriage isn't a true principle at that time? Does that mean that God didn't actually command it? Does that mean Joseph's making all this stuff? No, doesn't mean that either, right? So we don't need to jump to extremes here. It's like, he made a mistake. So the whole thing's bunk. Like, no, it's not. That's the premise of the restoration. God's working with weak, simple, error-prone, sinful prophets and apostles and other servants. And through people like that, he's bringing forth his marvelous work and wonder. And polygamy has some pretty rough spots. It's a hard topic for a lot of people to hear about. You know,
what is the hardest one that you've heard that people struggle with in your experience?
With plural marriage?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one. He didn't tell Emma. Yeah. Another one's he married a 14-year-old girl.
Yeah.
Right. What the innuendo is there is like, he's a pedophile, right?
Yeah.
Like how could he marry a 14-year-old girl, right?
Yeah.
And so
that's one of the assumptions.
Yeah. So people bring a lot of assumptions to this. So when you're doing church history, you got to be careful that you're always establishing the context, right? I like the analogy I like is, I just trying to think one day, like what's a good analogy for true facts out of context?
And
I thought about an electrical wire, right? Like you get an electric wire that doesn't have the protective rubber sheath.
Yeah.
You touch it. It's shocking, right?
Oh.
There are facts in church history that are true. But out of context, they're shocking.
Yeah.
They will shock you. Like if you say, you know, Joseph Smith married a 14-year-old girl? That's like,
what the heck?
I don't have any context. Like that's a shocking fact. That's actually a true fact, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the context is crucial for that fact, right? That this is Helen Marr Kimball, 14-year-old daughter of Heber C. Kimball, an apostle. And the proposal was made by her father, actually, Heber C. Kimball, apostle, that Joseph marry Helen as a way to link the Smith and Kimball families together. It would be an eternity-only sealing. Mm. There would be no sexuality. It was intended simply to link the families for eternity. Back in Nauvoo, they were trying to figure out, again, how to use the sealing keys. And, right, sometimes we think that God just gave Joseph a manual, like, here's how you use the sealing power. But he didn't. He gave him the keys and let him figure out along the way some of this stuff. And so they were doing sealings like horizontally, like dynastically,
really?
Like connecting families, like, yeah, horizontally rather than today. We just seal ourselves to our forefathers, our parents, grandparents.
Yeah.
But back then they were like sealing kind of horizontally to prophets and apostles and linking families together in this way, right? And so plural marriage was a means by which two families could join. Helen has actually written several, I think two books on her experience as a plural wife.
Mm.
So if you wanted to know, you should ask Helen. Like she-
Like go to her she, own go personal to, go first. To her.
Yeah, she believes Joseph's a true prophet all the way through. She's really bright. She's sharp. She's even sassy. She's got a fun personality. Like if you want to know about what that was like, was this some oppressive like dark guy trying to abuse his ecclesiastical power and taking advantage of like young girls, like, you know, like the worst possible slant that anyone could ever put on the story. It's like, when you actually investigate it under like careful scrutiny, like see the whole story, like none of that is even remotely true. Like, is it an uncomfortable fact that he married a 14-year-old girl? Sure. Is there anything sleazy that occurred as a result? No, this is the parents were involved, like super incredible parents, like Victorian, pure as they come. Like this was a religious act to connect two families. The end. No sexuality. No, like I don't think they were ever even in the same room again after that, right? Like that was it. So
to clarify this, the context really does matter. The context really does matter when you look at any piece of church history, and it's specifically, in this case, you're saying with polygamy, knowing the context, and with her 14-year-old, she, her parents had a desire to have her connected in the family.
Yeah.
But there are some allegations, and then this is one that I know of that people struggle with is, well, okay, some of the marriages were actually, there was sexual intercourse involved.
Right.
What's a way to look at that with an eternal or with looking at the context?
Yeah.
I know that's a really like blunt question.
No, that's good.
But do you know what I'm saying? Because I think that's one of the ones that I know. It's like, well, wait. If I was married to someone and I know that they're, this idea of Kimball, you know, it is connecting the families.
Yeah. No sexuality, no problem, sexuality. I guess.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
But when sexuality is introduced into it, that adds a whole other layer.
I think that's one of the elements that people are like, wait, I don't know if I could, that's just crazy.
Totally,
right?
Yeah. So the theological justifications for plural marriage in Doctrine and Covenants 132, there's four of them given, and one of those is to multiply and replenish the earth, right? So sexuality is inevitable for that to come to pass. So those are women who were not, that young. They're not that young. They're the people who were older, who were not married. And then he marries them for time and eternity, right? There's these time and eternity marriages. And so in that sense, in the new and everlasting covenant, it's now legal in the eyes of God, right? And so for them to attempt to create children would be authorized at that time, right? Mm. Same way that Old Testament Jacob, right? He's got four wives. That's where we get the 12 tribes of Israel. Like, that's how you get families that big, that quick. And so ironically, we have no DNA evidence of any
offspring
of Joseph that ever lived to maturity. There's stories that maybe there were some, but they died young or miscarriages or whatever. But yeah, man, Hugo Perego, he's our Latter-day Saint DNA expert, and he's looked at all the different claims of children of Joseph Smith besides Emma, and to this day can find none. So anyway, there was some sexuality with those who he was married to for time and eternity. Some of them said so, or we have journal accounts that say he spent the night with this one of his wives, like
constant.
Yep. They spent the whole night together. Right. That kind of thing.
They don't know for sure, but they're like, maybe
they were playing Uno. Nobody knows. But there was
assumed.
Yeah. It's,
but it is a fact that there were other, just calling it what it is.
That's right. In fact, when the church comes to the West, right. When we come out to Utah, there's these allegations that Joseph Smith was a polygamist, right. His own children who stayed back in Nauvoo with Emma, who never comes west, they wanted to sort of disprove that point. They wanted to disprove that their dad had started polygamy. They wanted it to be pinned on Brigham Young.
Interesting.
And so they actually send missionaries from Nauvoo to Utah, right, to try to help their cousins come back to the truth and get rid of this or get out of this Brigham Young cult or whatever. But the problem was that there were still several of their father's wives who were still alive. And so they wanted to interview them, right? And it's the alleged wives of our father Joseph. And so when they interview these women, they would ask them point blank, like, "Were you married to our dad?" And they would say, "Yes."
Mm.
And then they but did you have carnal relations with our father? Right. I mean, that's as close as you can get to, like, did you have sex? Right. Did you have carnal relations with our father? And they said, "Yes."
Right? Wow.
So that's how we get like a few of these women, like, yes, there were carnal relations with your father. So that created a conundrum for the church over in Nauvoo, right? The RLDS church at the time was, that's a conundrum. But, and there's still people that want to challenge today that Joseph Smith ever practiced polygamy. But I think that's ridiculous as you look at the evidence is overwhelming that he did, that he's the one that started it. And that, it was legit within the logic of the revelations of the restoration generally and of Doctrine and Covenants 132 specifically. Joseph was acting within the realm of propriety, if that makes sense. Yeah. So there's nothing that I've ever found in plural marriage that would disqualify Joseph Smith from being a true prophet of God. Like, there's nothing. It's like, if you knew this about his polygamy, then you'd be like, "Oh my gosh, like I'm out," right?
There's
nothing like that. Like there's uncomfortable things. There's things where you think you probably made a mistake there, right? Like you probably should have told Emma. The 14-year-old girl, that's a nothing burger when you understand. I mean, it's uncomfortable still, but it's not like, oh, he was doing some shenanigans, right? Marrying other men's wives, that's another one that some people are like, what the heck? He married other men's wives? It's like, yeah, but when you look at it, he's actually, most of those women were married to men who are not members of the church or were less active, who did not put any faith in the afterlife. But these women are faithful. And the understanding at the time was, right?
So
I'm giving context now, right?
Yeah.
Let's put some rubber around that electrical wire. The understanding at the time was you needed to be married probably in this life to somebody faithful to qualify for the celestial kingdom. And these women have these husbands who they know that's not going to happen with. And so oftentimes, well, we have a few scant records, and so I can't say often, but some records indicate that the husbands and the wives would approach Joseph and say, Could you just be sealed to my wife for eternity? I'll have her now. Yeah. You have her later. What do you say?
And they were members or not?
They were members or not. Yeah. Sometimes less active, sometimes not believers. And so they would just say, my wife, it keeps nagging me like she needs a celestial marriage or whatever. Would you marry her and for eternity? And I'll have her now. Right. So this is, there were no sexual, like there's no sex in those marriages, right? That's where it sounds shady. It's like he married 14 other men's wives. It's like,
yeah,
no sexuality. All right. Like that's the, in fact, I think that's why Joseph liked those marriages, right?
Yeah,
he could
technically
check the box of obedience. I'm keeping the commandment. He's also protecting Emma's emotions in terms of like, there's no sexuality with these women. So that was one way in which Joseph did plural marriages, which was trying to benefit those women according to the theology that you need to be married celestially to qualify for celestial kingdom. He's trying to help them in that way. Like Brigham Young's sister is another example. She's actually single, doesn't have another husband, but she's like 53, I think, at the time.
Yeah.
And she's like, I'm never going to get married. Like, I'm never, you know, like nobody will want me. And I'll just be an angel. I'll just be a ministering angel, you know? And Joseph says to her, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know if that's what you would really want.
Mm.
He said, you know, in fact, I'll marry you right now. She's 53.
Yeah.
Her name's Fanny Young. And he says, Brigham, will you seal us together? Would that be all right, Fanny? She's like, sure. So that he marries her there to say, all right, you now have a celestial marriage, right? Do they ever spend any time together after that single moment? Nothing of record, right? Like no sexuality. It was an eternity, another eternity only, right? Where he's just like, let's give you the ordinance and then we'll figure things out later. Now, to us, that seems pretty kind of loosey goosey, right? It's like, that's not as how we understand ceilings and all that stuff works, but they're working through in Nauvoo, like how to use the sealing power. Right. And so, I don't know. Was that too much information?
No, that wasn't too much information. Not at all. No, because to me, what I'm gathering from this is, number one, you got to look at the whole big picture in every situation. Number two, especially when it comes to plural marriage or polygamy.
Yeah.
But there's a distinction between the two of those we haven't gotten to. But
that's right.
It sounds like there's a people who are desiring to receive what they're understanding as exaltation.
Yeah.
And they want to be able to receive that. And in that case, with the women who, Sister Young, that you just explained, right? She wanted to have exaltation. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so Joseph's like, yeah, let's do it right now.
Let's do the ordinance.
Yeah. And so there's this ordinance base, and it sounds like a lot of the assumptions come from our perspective of this time, of where we are now.
Yeah.
And a lot of assumptions in general that I think is where a lot of the friction comes from.
Yeah, there's people, there's evidence, right? People in power, in positions of power, abusing that power.
Yeah, which happens.
To take advantage of people sexually, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so how's Joseph Smith any different, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, the redemption of Joseph Smith is in the details of those who are actually involved. You want to know how he was? Ask his wives, right? Was he good to them? Was he abusive? I would recommend Brian Hells. He's got the best scholarship on this, right? Yeah. Brian Hells, he's one of those I'd call, he's a primary scholar. He's just gone through all the evidence everywhere, paid a guy $50,000 to find any other evidence out there that we don't have, any letter in a trunk in someone's attic, like anything about Joseph Smith's polygamy, good, bad, ugly. Like, so he synthesized it all together, made it available online for free. If you go to his website, josephsmithspolygamy.org, he's got bios of all of Joseph Smith's wives, and then footnotes if you want to go deeper. And you can find out all you want to know. And again, I'll just say as a summary, there's nothing damning in that. There's nothing that disqualifies Joseph to being a true prophet of God, in my estimation. There's nothing uncomfortable. Yes. Disqualifying. No.
What's the difference in your perspective? What's the difference between the two of those?
Uncomfortable. It's about religion and sexuality, right?
Yeah.
So that's why it's uncomfortable. The disqualifying, like, does Joseph do anything? Is he like taking advantage of girls? Is he doing something that would be super sleazy, like, or even like a little bit sleazy? And there's no sleaze, there's no shenanigans, there's no abuse of his power. In fact, he would often propose to these women through their brother or their dad. like the protector of their virtue, the protector of their chastity. Like he would ask them, right, to propose to their sister or their daughter, whatever the case may be, on his behalf. That doesn't sound like the actions of someone who's just trying to take advantage of girls, right? You don't go to the brother. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of my favorites is Benjamin F. Johnson. When Joseph asked Benjamin F. Johnson to propose to his sister for Joseph, he explains plural marriage to him. And Benjamin F. Johnson's one of his best friends.
Yeah.
Benjamin F. Johnson, he looks him straight in the eye and he's like, Joseph, I've always known you to be a good man, a trustworthy man, and I will deliver your message to my sister. And if I find out that you're doing this to prostitute my sister, I will kill you personally.
Wow.
Joseph smiled and he said, thank you, Benjamin. He said, that day will never come and you'll live to have a testimony that plural marriage is a true principle.
Wow.
But does that sound like the actions of a man trying to take advantage of girls? You know what I mean? Like nothing sleazy. When you get to the details at this level, see how he's maneuvering, talking with the brother, talking with the dad, connecting people so that they can have access to the promises of exaltation in the celestial kingdom, not living with them, limited sexuality. There was some with those who were time and eternity, right? But no babies that come from that, right? I mean, there's like he's doing the best he can, I think, to set the example, to set the pattern that subsequent apostles will follow and will have babies and will be able to.
And if he didn't do it, they'd be like, well, he didn't do it.
Yeah.
And I know that's probably hard for people to swallow, but
sure.
I never thought about it that way. I never thought about any idea of setting an example for what it would be to come.
Yeah. And his life was cut short, frankly, right? I mean, he was just right in 1844, he's 38 and a half. Like, what would he have done had he lived longer? Would he have had children? No doubt, right? But things are as they happened, and so, but yeah, I think he did set the pattern for subsequent apostles and others.
Are there any? And I know that'd be hard. It's easy to just say that casually,
right?
Like, oh, he's just setting the pattern. That's not what we're trying to get at. Right. I just want to make that clear.
Right.
Is there any, because you obviously, you teach this, you believe this, okay?
Believe what?
You believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet. You believe.
Yes.
You believe that you understand a lot of the history of polygamy more than most. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you would say, and I'm not trying to stir up doubt, but I'm saying that we do know that we're not really sure about and it's not as clear for people. You've mentioned a few. That does that make sense? What I'm asking.
So, are there any?
Well, because you're saying like, there's no way he obviously was a prophet. He was this. Is there anything that might cause someone? What are the specific areas that are like? We've clarified many of them, but that they would question. That are a little bit like we're not sure yet. We're still figuring that out.
Yeah, I think just polygamy itself as a topic raises eyebrows because you're now mixing religion and sexuality and that already gets people edgy, right? Like,
yeah.
It's like, well, hold on. That sounds right. That could be. So just the topic itself is like eyebrow raising. But then the big three, I'd say the big three, he didn't tell Emma about some of the wives, 14-year-old girl.
Yeah.
And he married other men's wives. I think those are the biggest three that like just rankle people.
And right. We've reviewed those. We got
So if it's not, and if I agree, if you don't have context for those, theological context, historical context, emotional context, like all the right, the context of the times, like that can be that could be pretty devastating for your testimony, right? Like it jades your view of Joseph so strongly, right? That you kind of feel like you've been betrayed or beguiled. Like Joseph Smith is not what I thought, right? I thought he was a good man.
Yeah.
And here he is marrying 14-year-old girls.
And yeah.
Stealing other men's wives and stuff. You know, it's like, come on. Like we got to be honest when we're doing church history. We also have to be honest that sometimes the historical record is spotty on a lot of this. But from the record we do have, what we can piece together is not a picture of a guy abusing his authority or his power to take advantage of people. Here's a very reluctant polygamist who's trying to follow a commandment that's uncomfortable for him and his wife and all those who were involved in the first generation. Like that's the story that all the historical data tells most clearly, most transparently. Is that that's the story that's real, that's raw, that's in the record that we have. Everything else has to be innuendo. Everything else has to be spin. Everything else has to be, right, trying to twist it to make it look like Joseph is...
You don't have all the information, and you're like, well, what is that?
No, we'll tell you what's really going on. Right?
Yeah.
So just trying to be honest and aware of all the sources and the facts, aware of the people that were most closely involved, right? Sometimes we think we have more clarity on polygamy than those who are actually involved in it, right? We think we know Joseph's motives better than the wives, like, than the women he was married to, right?
It's like, yeah.
It's like, you know, that's not fair. That's not fair. That's not honest. That's not decent. Like, if you want to know, ask those who were involved.
Are there any other, so one of the big ones, number one, I would say, you mentioned that just the fallacy of prophets in general is one of the biggest myths. And yeah. Then within that, it connects really, really well
to
with polygamy.
Most church history problems.
So most church history problems are tied to, well, the polarization of, I either got to go 100% in and I will defend him to the death, or that I could, he's completely not and everything else is false.
Yeah.
Can you paint a picture for us a little bit better of, like, what does it look like in your experience of someone who just goes to the death, almost to the demise of the scenario, when someone like defends them to the death to where it can be damaging.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Can I do a sensitive one?
Yeah.
I mean, we're here, we're talking, let's just do it. I think one example is it's more real.